Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Epochs. Hello and welcome back to another instalment of Epochs, where I should be continuing my series all about Constantine the First, Constantine the Great, and his never-ending adventures. And he wants to be, I really don't think this is much of a spoiler alert, he really wants to be the sole ruler of the entire Roman world, Augustus style. Hadrian style, but he was born into a world where there wasn't one emperor. You remember quite a few episodes ago now, we was talking about the world of Diocletian and his tetrarchy. There were four emperors, two senior ones, one really is the most senior one, but two senior emperors, the Augusti, and two junior emperors, the Caesar. So four in total, tetrarchy, the rule of four. And then after Diocletian's time, just after the very next generation, there at one point was six, because there were, well, all sorts of machinations and all sorts of eddies in the story, all sorts of backs and forths. And there were six at one point, wasn't there? Three in the west had Licinius, who's supposed to be really the heir to Galerius, so the most powerful emperor in the east for sure, and supposed to be the most senior one of all, Licinius. And he had a junior Caesar under him, Severus, but there's also another person, Maximin, who they'd had to sort of recognize because he was a power in his own right. So there's three emperors in the east when there should only be two. And in the west, you had Constantine and Maxentius, but also Maxentius's father, the old Maximian, was still around. So there were six at one point. However, we're down to four because Constantine has taken full control of the west. Maximian, his own father-in-law, Constantine got married to Maximian's daughter, Fausta, and he tried to usurp Constantine, but Constantine beat him in the field and then had him executed. So then there's only two in the west, like there should be. But then there was a war between Constantine and Maxentius, who was also Maximian's brother and his wife's sister. It's all a bit incestuous, isn't it? And Constantine had marched on Rome to defeat him, the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. And he did beat him and then execute him. So he's executed his own wife's father and brother now. But she always stayed loyal to him after she was married to him. She always picked his side and everything. So there's now only one ruler in the West, and it's Constantine. But there's the whole East now, isn't there? Which is a whole different kettle of fish, a whole new world to have to try and conquer. So let's continue our story. I should be reading from Edward Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, as always, in this series. So let's pick up the story straight after Constantine had conquered Rome and defeated Maxentius. Gibbon tells us this, quote, "In the use of victory, Constantine neither deserved the praise of clemency nor incurred the censure of immoderate vigour. He inflicted the same treatment to which a defeat would have exposed his own person and family, i.e. he put to death the two sons of the tyrant," Maxentius had two sons, would have been his wife's nephews. He had to put them to death, and carefully extirpated his whole race, the whole family. The most distinguished adherents of Maxentius must have expected to share his fate, i.e. death, as they had shared his prosperity and his crimes. But when the Roman people loudly demanded a greater number of victims, the conqueror, Constantine, resisted with firmness and humanity those servile clamours which were dictated by flattery as well as by resentment. Informers were punished and discouraged. The innocent who had suffered under the late tyranny were recalled from exile and restored to their estates. A general act of oblivion quieted the minds and settled the property of the people both in Italy and in Africa." Again, we're just talking about North Africa there, really. "The first time that Constantine honoured the Senate with his presence, he recapitulated his own services and exploits in a modest oration. He assured that illustrious order of his sincere regard and promised to establish its ancient dignity and privileges in all but name. He's not bringing back the Republic. He's not going to give up the type of government which Diocletian had started, the dominate. He's not going back to the principate of Augustus, you know, pretending there's a Republic and he's merely the first citizen. He's not going back to that. He is the emperor, the true military absolute emperor. But still, he showed the Senate respect, its ancient dignity and privileges. The grateful Senate repaid these unmeaning professions by the empty titles of honour which it was yet in their power to bestow. And without presuming to ratify the authority of Constantine, they passed a decree to assign him the first rank among the three Augusti who governed the Roman world. That's not going to go down well with Licinius in the East, is it? Who considers himself the most senior Augusti. Games and festivals were instituted to preserve the fame of his victory, and several edifices raised at the expense of Maxentius were dedicated to the honour of his successful rival. The triumphal arch of Constantine still remains a melancholy proof of the decline of the arts and a singular testimony of the meanest vanity. End quote. And it's still there to this day, Gibbon writing at the end of the 18th century, very end of the 18th century. And the Arch of Constantine is still in Rome today. Gibbon throws a bit of shade on it, doesn't he, there, saying it's not that good as like a piece of art. I think it's quite impressive. Okay, he goes on saying, as it was not possible to find in the capital of the empire a sculptor who was capable of adorning that public monument, the Arch of Trajan, without any respect either for his memory or for the rules of propriety, was stripped of its most elegant figures. The difference of times and persons, of actions and characters, was totally disregarded. The Parthian captives appeared prostrate at the feet of a prince who never carried his arms beyond the Euphrates. That's an interesting thing to note. They just took the things of Trajan's arch and put it on Constantine's, even though it doesn't make sense. Because, of course, Trajan had many and great adventures out in the East. Constantine never does that. Still. And curious antiquarians, like historians, can still discover the head of Trajan on the trophies of Constantine. The new ornaments, which it was necessary to introduce between the vacancies of ancient sculpture, are executed in the rudest and most unskillful manner. End quote. It is interesting to note that the sculptures and art that is genuinely contemporary with Constantine is of a ruder and less skillful level than, you know, 200 years earlier, 300 years earlier. It is more simplistic, more sort of stylized. You know, the higher point of Roman art, let's say, is very realistic, very, very realistic in sort of the Grecian manner. But when we see actual contemporary statues of Constantine, they're more simplistic, blatantly are. Okay, Gibbon continues saying this. The final abolition of the Praetorian Guards was a measure of prudence as well as of revenge. Most of them died on the field of battle at the Milvian Bridge, but not all of them. Those haughty troops whose numbers and privileges had been restored and even augmented by Maxentius were forever suppressed by Constantine. Their fortified camp was destroyed, and the few Praetorians who had escaped the fury of the sword were dispersed among the legions and banished to the frontiers of the empire, where they might be serviceable without again becoming dangerous. It was about time. The Praetorian Guard had been a pain in the arse as far as power politics is concerned for a few hundred years here. Yeah, it's prudent, absolutely prudent. By suppressing the troops which were usually stationed in Rome, Constantine gave the fatal blow to the dignity of the Senate and the people, i.e. real power. That was their final straw of real power in Rome, not the Senate, the Praetorian Guard. And now Rome is stripped of even that. And the disarmed capital was exposed without protection to the insults or neglect of its distant master. And if we look ahead in history to barbarians, yes. We may observe that in this last effort to preserve their expiring freedom, the Romans, from the apprehension of a tribute, had raised Maxentius to the throne. He exacted that tribute from the same Senate under the name of a free gift. Remember, Maxentius had done that. He just started saying, you, the rich people of Rome, basically, the rich families of Rome, you should really be giving me gifts, money gifts, massive ones, kind of all the time. I'll just make up new reasons why you should do. And somebody in my family's just had a baby or just got married or it's the gods have said you need to give me more money now. Quote, free gifts, quote. They implored the assistance of Constantine. He vanquished the tyrant and converted the free gift into a perpetual tax. So out of the frying pan into the fire, as far as they're concerned. Constantine cemented all of that into law, if anything. The senators, according to the declaration which was required of their property, were divided into several classes. The most opulent paid annually £8 of gold. The next class paid 4, the last 2, and those whose property might have claimed an exemption were assessed, however, at 7 pieces of gold. Besides the regular members of the Senate, their sons, their descendants, and even their relations enjoyed the vain privileges and supported the heavy burdens of the senatorial order. Nor will it any longer excite our surprise that Constantine should be attentive to increase the number of persons who were included under so useful a description. After the defeat of Maxentius, the victorious emperor, Constantine, passed no more than 2 or 3 months in Rome, which he visited twice during the remainder of his life, to celebrate the solemn festivals of the 10th and the 20th years of his reign. Constantine was almost perpetually in motion to exercise the legions or to inspect the state of the provinces. Treves, Milan, Aquileia, Sirmium, Nisus, and Thessalonica were the occasional places of his residence, till he founded a new Rome on the confines of Europe and Asia. That is, of course, Constantinople, nowadays Istanbul. There was a settlement there, an old settlement, goes back to ancient times, Greek times, or very near there anyway. But Constantine founded the city of Constantinople, as the name suggests, the city of Constantine, Constantinople. More on that later. Gibbon goes on saying this. Before Constantine marched into Italy, he had secured the friendship, or at least the neutrality, of Licinius, the Illyrian emperor. I mean, he was from Illyria originally, but he was emperor of the whole of the Eastern Roman world. He had promised his sister, Constantia, in marriage to that prince, but the celebration of the nuptials was deferred to after the conclusion of the war he was having with Maxentius, and the interview of the two emperors at Milan, which was appointed for that purpose, appeared to cement the union of their families and interests. In the midst of the public festivity, they were suddenly obliged to take leave of each other. An inroad of the Franks summoned Constantine to the Rhine, and the hostile approach of the sovereign of Asia, Persia, demanded the immediate presence of Licinius in the east. Maximin, the other emperor in the east, had been the secret ally of Maxentius, and without being discouraged by his fate, he resolved to try the fortune of civil war. Maximin in the east, feel like he could take on Licinius, and maybe probably ultimately Constantine as well. Maximin fancies his chances. We'll team up with the locals to try and get that done. So Licinius and Constantine were going to try and patch things up with a marriage, but in the middle of it, they were both drawn away to troubles on the frontiers. Gibbon says, he moved out of Syria, this is Maximin, he moved out of Syria towards the frontiers of Bithynia in the depth of winter. The season was severe and tempestuous. Great numbers of men, as well as of horses, perished in the snow. And as the roads were broken up by incessant rains, he was obliged to leave behind him a considerable part of the heavy baggage, which was unable to follow the rapidity of his forced marches. By this extraordinary effort of diligence, he arrived, with a harassed but formidable army, on the banks of the Thracian Bosphorus, before the lieutenants of Licinius were apprised of his hostile intentions. Byzantium surrendered to the power of Maximin after a siege of 11 days, Byzantium, so where Constantinople is going to be built, as I said, there's already an ancient settlement there. It's just not a giant city. It's not sort of some sort of new Rome, not a capital of the Roman world or anything. But it is in a strategically vital position. Anyway, Byzantium, as it was then, surrendered to Maximin after a siege of 11 days. He was detained some days under the walls of Heraclea, which is very nearby, and he had no sooner taken possession of that city than he was alarmed by the intelligence that Licinius had pitched his camp at the distance of only 18 miles. So we're going to have a showdown between the two Roman emperors of the east, main ones, Maximin and Licinius. They're going to go head to head. After a fruitless negotiation in which the two princes attempted to seduce the fidelity of each other's adherents, they had recourse to arms. The Emperor of the East commanded a disciplined and veteran army of about 70,000 men, and Licinius, who had collected about 30,000 Illyrians, was at first oppressed by the superiority of their numbers. His military skill and the firmness of his troops restored the day and obtained a decisive victory. Licinius won. The incredible speed which Maximin exerted in his flight after he lost the battle is much more celebrated than his prowess in the battle. 24 hours afterwards, he was seen pale, trembling, and without his imperial ornaments at Nicomedia, 160 miles from the place of his defeat. Like brave, brave Sir Robin, he ran away. The wealth of Asia was yet unexhausted, and though the flower of his veterans had fallen in the late action, he had still power, if he could obtain time, to draw very numerous levies from Syria and Egypt. But he survived his misfortune of losing that battle against Licinius for only 3 or 4 months longer. His death, which happened at Tarsus, was variously ascribed to despair, to poison, and to the divine justice. Either way, Maximin is dead, loses a big battle to Licinius, and is dead. As Maximin was alike destitute of abilities and of virtue, he was lamented neither by the people nor by the soldiers. The provinces of the East, delivered from the terror of civil war, cheerfully acknowledged the authority of Licinius. One less emperor on the board again now. We're down to 3 in total. Constantine in the West, Licinius in the East, and a more junior one in the East, Severus. So Gibbon tells us this, saying, "The vanquished emperor left behind him 2 children, a boy of about 8 and a girl of about 7 years old. Their inoffensive age might have excited compassion." I mean, they might have just been left alone because they're small children. "But the compassion of Licinius was a very feeble resource, nor did it restrain him from extinguishing the name and memory of his adversary. The death of Severus will admit of less excuse, as it was dictated neither by revenge nor by policy. The conqueror had never received any injury from the father of that unhappy youth, and the short and obscure reign of Severus in a distant part of the empire was already forgotten. But the execution of Candidianus was an act of the blackest cruelty and ingratitude. He was the natural son of Galerius," remember Galerius, who had been ruler in the East before Licinius, and Licinius's benefactor and very, very close friend, even childhood friend. Galerius took over from, really basically took over from Diocletian as the main emperor in the Roman world. And after he'd gone, Licinius was considered, at least by him or by most, to be the most senior Roman emperor. Well, he also had some children, Galerius, well, kills them as well. And it's the blackest cruelty and ingratitude. He, this Candidianus, the natural son of Galerius, he was the natural son of Galerius and friend and benefactor of Licinius. The prudent father had judged him too young to sustain the weight of a diadem, a crown, an imperial crown. But he hoped that, under the protection of princes who were indebted to his favour for the imperial purple, Candidianus might pass a secure and honourable life. Well, that was a miscalculation. He was now advancing towards the 20th year of his age, so not a child anymore, this Candidianus, and the royalty of his birth, though unsupported either by merit or ambition, was sufficient to exasperate the jealous mind of Licinius. To these innocent and illustrious victims of his tyranny, we must add the wife and daughter of the Emperor Diocletian, who was still alive. When that prince conferred on Galerius the title of Caesar, he had given him in marriage to his daughter Valeria, whose melancholy adventures might furnish a very singular subject for tragedy. She had fulfilled and even surpassed the duties of a wife. As she had not any children herself, she condescended to adopt the illegitimate son of her husband, and invariably displayed towards the unhappy Candidianus the tenderness and anxiety of a real mother. After the death of Galerius, her ample possessions provoked the avarice, greed, and her personal attractions excited the desires of his successor, Maximin. He had a wife still alive, but divorce was permitted by the Roman law, and the fierce passions of the tyrant demanded an immediate gratification. The answer of Valeria was such as became the daughter and widow of emperors, but it was tempered by the prudence which her defenceless condition compelled her to observe. She represented to the persons whom Maximin had employed on this occasion, quote, that even if honour could permit a woman of her character and dignity to entertain a thought of second nuptials, decency at least must forbid her to listen to his addresses at a time when the ashes of her husband and his benefactor were still warm, while the sorrows of her mind were still expressed by her mourning garments. She ventured to declare that she could place very little confidence in the professions of a man whose cruel inconsistency was capable of repudiating a faithful and affectionate wife. So she says no. On this repulse, the love of Maximin was converted into fury, and as witness and judges were always at his disposal, it was easy for him to cover his fury with an appearance of legal proceedings and to assault the repudiation as well as the happiness of Valeria. Her estates were confiscated, her eunuchs and domestics devoted to the most inhuman tortures, and several innocent and respectable matrons who were honoured with her friendship suffered death on a false accusation of adultery. The Empress herself, together with her mother, Prisca, was condemned to exile, and as they were ignominiously hurried from place to place before they were confined to a sequestered village in the deserts of Syria, they exposed their shame and distress to the provinces of the East, which, during 30 years, had respected their august dignity. Diocletian, like the retired Diocletian, he spent many, many years in retirement. The retired Diocletian made several ineffectual efforts to alleviate the misfortunes of his daughter. And as the last return that he expected for the imperial purple, which he had conferred upon Maximin, he entreated that Valeria might be permitted to share his retirement at Salona and to close his eyes to her afflicted father. He entreated, but as he could no longer threaten, his prayers were received with coldness and disdain, and the pride of Maximin was gratified in treating Diocletian as a suppliant and his daughter as a criminal. We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No.